Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. This is Jane Karwoski, experimental psychologist, Dr. J, along with my co-host, Jim Nico. Jim is the founder and CEO of our parent company, Social Network Intermedia, LLC, of which I am the chief science officer. Today, we're going to be talking with Malcolm McCullough. The superabundance of information that you enjoy today is wonderful and amazing, isn't it? You can get information on just about anything you want, anytime you want. Around the world, most people access the internet through their smartphone. That is becoming increasingly the case here in the U.S. as well. The trouble is, people just don't ever put them down. There are obvious negative consequences to this, such as walking in front of a bus. But today, architecture and design professor Malcolm McCullough will suggest to you some not-so-obvious results of perpetual residence in cyberspace. Before joining Taubman College of the University of Michigan in 2001, Mr. McCullough served on the design faculty at Carnegie Mellon and for 10 years at Harvard. Going back even further, he was a pioneer of computer-aided design, or CAD. He's the author of Abstracting Craft and Digital Design, but most importantly for you and your interest in the impact of the internet, he has given a great deal of thought to how our attention as a valuable personal resource is increasingly sought after and how we can manage the many and constant demands on our attention in this age of plenty, which he explores in his latest book, Ambient Commons, published by MIT Press. So let's get into that. Malcolm, welcome to the Social Network Show.
Good afternoon, Jane. Hello, gentle listeners.
Now, I'm the only person I know of that has referred to my audience as gentle listeners. I know we have a lot in common.
Well, first of all, thank you for coming, because the bottom line here is, like, when I hear of this brilliant, diverse background, I mean, you're bringing a whole different dimension to the show in terms of what we understand about being online and on computers. Thank you.
It's my pleasure, and I understand you've had lots of other guests from lots of other walks of life, and that's the way to do it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's amazing how many different angles the similar questions have been attacked by, you know, in academia, different disciplines are involved in asking the same questions, but looking at them from a whole different angle. But in terms of demands on our attention, what is so special or new and different about today? Is it just a case of we're paying more attention to it? Or what do you think has changed?
Well, I think that the world has way more kinds of information media in way more situations of life. Let me take a minute to say what I mean by that.
Okay.
You used the word cyberspace. Once upon a time, that was people thought that you would sit at a computer, park your atoms, go through the looking glass into some magical other world. Not so much now. Now it's flooding out everywhere. It's on the street. You wear it, build into stuff. Think mm-hmm. about it. There are more kinds of media, much greater diversity of formats, from the very, very big media facades, for instance, to the very, very small little micro chips built into everything, and in more kinds of activities, of course, like maybe all activities. Is it anything that people do that has not been done while also texting?
Unfortunately, probably not.
We're not here to talk about that. We're not going to talk about that. Now, technologically, the big change, which you've already alluded to, is that a computer is no longer necessarily something you sit at. Computers get carried and even worn, you know, like with all this Google Glass stuff coming our way. and of course, build into things, which is what I'm here to talk about today. And as you said, indeed, for most people, the smartphone is the primary form of access. And outside the United States, it's usually the only one. It's changed and it's caught on faster than things like cars or televisions, which I heard they changed the world, those ones.
You know, you mentioned cars, and I just wonder, you know, sometimes it helps to look at how new technology was adopted back when it was new, although it is now old to us, the automobile, for instance. Sometimes I think of myself as wanting to maintain my paper records as almost as if the person who wanted to keep a horse just in case the car didn't work. I don't know if that's comparable, but what was it like when the car was a brand new thing?
Well, once upon a time, the technology that was there anything people do that had not been done while also using that technology was cars. Think of, say, for example, the 1950s. And once upon a time, the whole built world was getting set up so that everybody would do everything in cars. And only a half a century later are the social or environmental or political or other costs of that becoming evident. In my field, we study the built environment, and I have colleagues who can give you hard numbers on how America now has a 20-year backlog of demand for walkable places to live and work and a 20-year oversupply of McMansions. But that's not what we're really here to talk about today. I think what we're really here to talk about today is this business of this layer of media on physical places, as though the street itself is a platform for technology now. Some people call it urban computing. Some people call it augmented reality. Some people call it, I don't know what, I mean, there'll be a new name for it next month. Just take a moment to consider how many sites of life and how many things have acquired a layer of mediation or of displays, sensors. Think how many more things have sensors in them, or how many things have a wireless connection in them, or how many things are executing code while you do something.
That's right.
It's a whole other world. There's a lot of talk out there, for example, of Internet of Things.
Yes, I was wondering if you were...
But now, also, the media are full of stories about all this stuff that's very technocentric. So today, let's talk about this as a cultural challenge, right? And maybe there's time here to do it both individually and some civic ideas as well.
What could be some examples? I mean, I understand what you're saying, but where would I look? Say, I walk into a coffee shop. Where do I see a layer? Can you give me an example of a layer that I might not readily think of?
Well, I mean, when's the last time you had a drink someplace where there wasn't a television screen over just everybody's shoulder?
Oh,
I think there are like two places left in my town
where
you can do that.
Perfect.
Picture buying gas. Jane and I were talking about this the other day. Picture at the gas station, there might be an NBC feed monitor in the pump. There's a little ticker crawl. They've got this new thing where they attach a panel to the hose to get still more advertising space. There might be a sticker right on the handle. Walk inside, and there's a big slow-in on the food, and then there's a whole array of little monitors for buying lottery tickets, and there's nobody to help you because that guy's watching the bank of monitors himself. Meanwhile, the kids are in the car watching movies on seatbacks because cars are now built on the assumption that kids do not find the world going by very interesting. They would rather watch movies. That's a good one. I mean, there are others. Think, for example, about shopping checkouts, or I don't know about where you work, but where I work, meeting rooms, they're layered over in all kinds of things.
Wow, I get it. Yeah, you know, there's
public plazas, hotel lobbies. Anything medical, at the gym. And anyway, it's just everywhere.
Well,
There, in my town, there are two places left to shop where there isn't music coming out of the ceiling.
Fortunately,
one of them's a hardware store, and one of them's a grocery store, and that matters a lot to me because I like to think about how these things are going to go together later that I'm buying. Which things do I need to buy? How are they going to go together?
I
need to hear myself think.
Yeah, you're actually paying attention to the task at hand rather than trying to tune out and be distracted by, it's almost as if, well, like I said at the beginning, your attention is a personal resource, and there's advertisers, commerce, trying to grab it. Your attention is up for grabs. And let's get into that a little bit more in the next segment. And we can talk about, you have so many fascinating ideas on this topic. So we'll look forward to them in the next segment.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
I'm Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world, so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to The Social Network Show.
Welcome back to The Social Network Show, where we are speaking with Malcolm McCullough, Professor of Architecture and Design at the University of Michigan. Now, we are talking mainly today about attention, and Malcolm, you have a unique take on this, I think, especially in terms of maybe what is happening to us as human beings in terms of our attention, neurologically, as well as just in terms of mental health. Can you tell us something about that?
I'd be happy to, but I hope it's not a unique take. I'm just one more guy figuring out how to survive the 21st century. just about everybody I know has attention issues, whether you want to call it burnout or overload or overconsumption or what. And yet, nobody I know, I have never met a person who says, geez, wasn't life better before that darn internet?
Uh-huh.
And so there are things to think about, all right. And coming from a discipline that cares about the world that people live in and tries to make it better where they can, I'm very, very interested in the relationship between attention and surroundings. So I've made an amateur inquiry into all of this. I mean, there's real brain scientists around here, and I want to talk to them about all that, but I'm not one of those. Mm-hmm. And I would be careful, anybody who's listening, be very, very careful about anybody who says that brain science proves that we all think like this and not like that. Be very, very skeptical about studies that prove that technology makes us smarter, us stupid. What you mean we, Kemosabe? And which technology and what studies? I think it's all wide open. And if you talk to cognition people, I mean, attention really is the holy grail.
Well, yes, because, for instance, the whole issue of multitasking, there's people like to think of neural plasticity or the fact that the human brain can adapt and grow and everything, but this isn't necessarily the case when it comes to attention.
Let's not jump ahead quite so quickly on this. There's some much more fundamental things to say first.
Okay.
The first thing to say is that you might have heard something about it being an information economy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not actually the case. Information is super abundant and often free. What's scarce, what's the coin of the realm, is attention. What's being bought and sold is attention. You know the old one that if you're on some online service or app or something that's free, what's being bought and sold is you. This was identified a long, long time ago. When I was in high school, the famous scientist Herb Simon said, "Wait a minute! In an information economy, what's it cost? Yeah, the cost is obvious. What information consumes is the attention of its recipients. So if it's an attention economy, then attention is not something that people just throw around and give away. And if it's an attention economy, then good habits of attention, mindfulness to attention, has payoff, presumably, somehow. Now, another thing that always has to be said that people forget is that attention isn't necessarily something that you pay. How many people were taught in school pay attention?
right.
Oh my God, why should I pay attention to this radio interview? It's one more thing demand on my time. No. Sometimes attention flows. Sometimes attention is effortless. And what this inquiry here and this particular conversation that's going on here right now offers, our value proposition, is that if you take the time and effort to become more mindful about attention practices, that will pay off down the line. So it's like a highway resurfacing project right here. This is the temporary inconvenience of having to listen to one more talk about something, offering a long-term improvement in mindfulness to attention. Where my inquiry comes in is about surroundings, okay?
Uh-huh.
So this is really the key thing. The key thing to understand is that some kind of fascination with and mindfulness to surroundings is not one more thing to keep track of, and oh my God, can't we just tune the world out? No, it keeps you more grounded, of course, and it keeps other media in perspective. Well, except, wait a minute, surroundings sometimes aren't media at all. Sometimes it's just the sun falling on a wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a paradox that by remaining aware of yet more, namely, you know what phase the moon is in right now, for instance? Or do you walk on one side of the street or another at different times of year, depending on the sun, or do you actually go around and open and close windows in your house when the weather changes or the cycle of the day, stuff like that. Yet another realm of stuff to keep track of. Paradoxically, that keeps everything else in a little bit better balance. Let's talk about that.
The restoring...
With respect to what the things you brought up about habits and neuroplasticity and multitasking, blah, blah, blah. Let's go there. Consider one distinction that I consider very important. Imagine the difference between entertainment and fascination.
Okay.
If I could only have one thing to say on the air here, I'd ask people to pause and consider the difference between entertainment and fascination. All right? More specifically, think how much casual entertainment fills up every little bit of dead space culturally. It gets wedged into every little crack in life, right? Versus quiet fascination, sometimes with things that nobody put there at all. They're just there already, like I'm watching a tree in the wind right now.
Mm-hmm.
Consider the fascination that comes with doing something well, having a practice of something. Maybe it's a musical instrument, or maybe it's a sport, or martial art, or something. I don't know. Versus the casual, distracted entertainment of, oh my God, it's another red light, out comes a phone. I got it. It's 90 seconds till this light's going to change.
Better make use of that. Well,
Wait. I got one. This is, first of all, this is such brilliant, the insights and the way of looking at the world. I've got one, Malcolm, check this out. I think I read this maybe in Sherry Turkle's book from Harvard, Alone Together. I'm not positive, but if I did, here's what it was. There were these kids that had been looking at a computer screen and seeing fish. When we first saw fish on a computer screen, and they were like in an aquarium type environment, and then these kids got used to this, and then when they were in a boat on a lake and they saw fish in the water, they said, "Those aren't real fish in the water. They're not acting like those fish on the screen," you know. I think that's the baseline for these kids was an artificial one, and so I think what you're saying is so important.
Well, where I live, people do drive down the interstate like there's an undo key.
Undo key?
Let's not up the ante to a full-blown philosophical discussion of what is real. But one of the nice operating definition is reality is that which remains true after you cease believing it.
Wow,
I don't know who said that. I think where to go with this is that there are some generational differences brought about by all these changes in the world, by the perpetual nature of mediation, and by growing up constantly having, maybe not looking out the window of a car as you drive down the road.
Right.
Let alone not going for a walk. And there are allegations, which nobody has any hard data on, that here in Michigan there are children who have never gone for a walk, but got driven everywhere, always.
And there are lots of stories in the news
about the criminality of children being at a playground or without a parent watching them every minute. And there's a lot of thought that if a child is unattended for a minute, they're going to die! But they're not. Okay, so let's not go there. But instead, let's just think a little bit about these generational differences in a more positive way. There is an expression out there that I think is a very interesting debate. And I hope you could get somebody. You had Howard Gardner on, right? Get somebody on to talk about digital natives, right?
Right, and possibly the existence of a nature deficit disorder. I ran across that,
deficit disorder is a good one. Or a lot of people are worried about attention deficit disorder, but I think there's also television excess disorder. For example, my kid's third grade assignment said, please have your kid do your homework in a room of the house with not a television on, implying that usually there's a television on somewhere. In fact, it's not every room.
Mm-hmm.
That's just bizarre.
Okay.
So back on this digital natives thing, the digital natives argument goes, basically, the shortest possible version is that whatever you grow up with, that becomes normal to you.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
The counter argument is, no, actually, the human perceptual apparatus took a long time, thousands of years, to become what it is, and it cannot change overnight.
Right, and right? So the human adaptability.
So the middle ground is that there is some adaptability, this neuroplasticity that we're talking about. There's a word that's fun to toss around, and that there are limits to that. The human mind is somewhat adaptable. You can train your brain in some regards, and you better, but not just however you please. It can't be made into just anything. Now, consider analogies, for example, the usual story, good one to tell every time, or any analogies in food.
Okay,
right?
And
human beings are disposed to, through thousands of years of adaptation, to take on salt, fat, and sugar whenever possible, because those were always really scarce.
Uh-huh.
And now, at least for the luckiest billion humans, they aren't scarce. They're super abundant. And a lot of people are taking on a little more salt or fat or sugar than they should.
Okay.
And moreover, they're often taking that on instead of what they need. This is the empty calories argument, that you graze so much trying to get the thing that you actually need that you end up taking on a whole lot. Now, analogously, there do exist arguments. I haven't delved into this so far myself. There do exist arguments about so-called information obesity. I think it's fair to say that in the world of media, there are some empty calories out there. And I think it's fair to say a lot of people are taking on a whole lot of stuff that they were disposed as living beings to take on, like stuff that flashes brightly in your peripheral vision,
mm-hmm.
or things that are shiny, or things that flicker, or messages.
The alerts.
People are taking those on because those were always scarce. Only now they're not. What does this mean to you individually? What can you do individually? It's a matter of habits, it's a matter of sensibility. Habits of noticing surroundings will create sensibilities that allow some of these other things to distract you less and that balance out the time frames in your life.
Thank you. That is what I was really looking for, too, was something we can do about this. And maybe even if it's just looking out the window or going outside for a break is going to help us. So thank you so much. That's Malcolm McCullough of the University of Michigan. And thank you for listening. Please mention to your social networks online and off that you enjoy The Social Network Show. And check out our webpage, thesocialnetworkshow.com. And if you like receiving email updates, click on the blog tab for the subscription form to receive those email updates. So until we welcome you here again, please have fun and be safe online and off.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.